ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 And verse 37. Siddhasya vittissata eva siddhihi. Siddhasya vittissata eva siddhihi. Swapna upamana kalu siddhiyonyaha. Svapnaupamanak kalu siddhiyonyaha Svapnaprabuddhasya katanya satyaha Satistitakim punareti mayam Siddhasya vittihi sattaha evam eva siddhihi Swapna upamanaha kalu siddhiyaha anyaha Swapnaha prabuddhasya katam nusatyaha Sati stitaha kim punar eti punaha eti mayam
Siddha. The word siddha, you know the word sadhana? Sadhana means the means to an end. That which is achieved is siddha. Siddhi, so we have sadhana, siddha, past passive participle, and siddhi, and a noun. So for any sadhana is meant to achieve something. So the thing that is achieved is called the siddha, that which is achieved. The siddhi is the achievement. So we have the means for achieving that which is achieved, and then the siddhi, the achievement itself. Now we also use the word siddhi, and this is how in the commentary they talk about it. The word siddhi we also use in terms of these supernatural powers, like being able to astral travel and read minds, be clairvoyant, all of these, right, become big, become small, all of these different siddhis that you can attain through yogic practices and extreme tapas and that type of thing. So this is also known as siddhis. So here, from the commentary, but I'll talk about it otherwise also, but what it says is, it's vittihi of the vittihi. Vittihi means knowledge. The knowledge, the knowing. So it comes from vid, to know, so vittihi. We don't usually see that form, but vittihi means knowledge. Siddhasya sattaha. The vitti, the knowledge of sat, is accomplished, right? It's the knowledge of a sat, of what is sat, which is itself siddhaha. I'll talk about this in different ways, but he says, that knowledge of sat, which is in fact already accomplished, that alone is the siddhi. That is what the siddhi is. That is what is in fact the accomplishment. Knowledge of sat. Sat means that which exists in all three periods of time, that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. That's sat. That which, another way of saying for sat, that which actually is, what actually exists, that which exists and can't be negated, it can't go into non-existence. So the real definition of sat is that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. And so that sat is already, and would have to be, already accomplished. Right? That sat already is. Because by definition, that which can't be negated in past, present, or future, that already is accomplished. It's already a fact. So now, it's knowledge of that sat, of that which is sat, right? Which is already accomplished, which is siddhasya sattaha, That alone is siddhi. That alone is the accomplishment. That alone is an accomplishment. He says, swapna upamanaha kalu siddhiyaha anyaha. Indeed, kalu, emphasis, siddhiyaha anyaha. All accomplished, all, anya means other. Other accomplishments, other achievements, right, in the plural, siddhiyaha anyaha, all other achievements, they are swapna upamanaha. They are just like the dream. They enjoy the same reality as a dream. He says, swapnaha prabuddhasya, the dream, the swapna, the dream, prabuddhasya, for someone who has woken up, katam nu satya. How can that be satya? How can that be considered as real? Would you take that to be a real accomplishment, a real siddhi? No. So satyam, once for the person who has woken up, the dream, the whole dream itself, how could that be taken to be real? He says, sati stittaha, for someone who is abiding in sat, means for someone who, jivanmukta, ajnani, who has recognized the sat, that which actually is, who's abiding, who's placed themselves in that sat, kim punar eti mayam. How again can they go into Maya? How again can they dip into Maya? And that's his verse. So let's just look at it for a minute. If we look at the definition of sat or satyam as that which can't be negated in past, present, or future, what that means is, what according to the definition of sat, it can't be subject to change. So it is, because we're not talking about a sat, something that doesn't have any existence. We're talking about something that actually is, but that which is, and at the same time, not be bound by change. There is nothing in the creation that fits those, that qualification. There is nothing that exists within time and space that isn't bound by change. And so what this means is anything that we experience, because we do experience the entire creation, including my body, my mind, my sense organs, my thoughts, my perceptions, and the world, we do experience it as is. Like, for instance, I could say, like, the painting is, the wall is, the rug is, the chair is, I am, you are, everything that I experience, including any thought in my mind, it is. I have a happy thought, I have a sad thought, any emotion is. There is no experience that doesn't enjoy being. And so it's not that being or sat, remember another thing, is that the sat, the word sat, it's actually... grammatically, the word sat is a present participle. And a present participle comes from a verbal root. So the verbal root here is us. Us means to be. A present participle is being. Like if I say, take the root, like gum gutch, to go, then gachan would be going. Krit, to do, you know. It would be... karoti, something like karot or something like that would be the present participle, but do, doing, walk, walking. So be, being. Okay? So being, so now if we have this being, there is nothing in your experience that is away from this verbal root, us to be. Everything receives it, every experience that you have. But there is nothing which we experience as having that being that fits the definition of being. And we don't even bother with that. We don't even think of being itself as being satyam. It's almost like just an adjective that's thrown onto things that we experience as being. Right? And so we can say, we can give that adjective to anyone, anything. But we don't experience or we don't think about being itself as a substantive, as a noun. Right? We don't think like that. We just lop it onto everything that we experience. But the definition of being in Vedanta is that which is and can never be negated. Existence itself is viewed as a substantive, as a noun. And so all of these things, in a sense, are qualifying that substantive. So sometimes Swamiji will say, instead of you saying the table is, say table isness. The table isness, chair isness, you know, painting isness, body isness, emotion isness, right? Where these things become qualifiers to isness. But the thing to understand, say if you do look at it like that, everything is a qualifier to isness. There's one thing to understand in that there is nothing in your experience that is not a qualifier to isness, to being. But there's a difference in the order of reality of the two things, the qualifiers and the substantive, because the qualifiers are all subject to non-isness, to non-being, because they're all subject to change. The instant something changes, the prior condition no longer is. And so any experience that you have is bordered by non-being, by the mere fact that it changes. But every experience that is enjoying being when it is. See what I mean? So being, in fact, it never ever changes. And everything that comes and goes is coming and going in being. We don't usually think of it like that. But now what Ramana is saying is that actually it's the set itself which is, and that alone is already set, is already accomplished. So there's nothing to really gain there. So the siddhi, the accomplishment, which is really the only real accomplishment according to the definition of reality, the only real accomplishment is the accomplishment not of sat, of being, because being already is. It's siddha. Sat is siddha. It's already accomplished because it's free of time. And so it's not the accomplishment of being we're looking for. The accomplishment is the knowledge, the vitti, the knowledge of being. So that's why it says vittihi, the knowledge sattaha of sat, which is siddha. So it's the knowledge of sat, of being itself, which is already accomplished, being which is already accomplished, it's that knowledge which is siddhi. That is the siddhi. That is the true accomplishment, that knowledge. Any other thing that we call a siddhi, siddhiyaha is the plural of siddhi. Anyaha means another. And other siddhis are really equal to dream. They're equal to dream. Why? Because in these siddhi, even if you're looking at the human accomplishments and even some of these magical accomplishments that are known as the yogic siddhis, whatever the yogic siddhis may be, or whatever the human accomplishments, because that will be just an extension, all of those siddhis are states of experience that have a beginning and an end. And anything that has a beginning and an end is only when it's there. In other words, anything that has a beginning and an end, which all siddhis, all accomplishments within Maya have beginning and end, they actually don't have any being at all. Why? Because they're bordered by non-being. So we say, anything that comes into being or goes out of being, what does it have on either side of it? I'll tell you the reason we never even think about this, and it doesn't bother us at all, is only because, in fact, things that come into being and go out of being never have had any being at all. They are what we call mitya, right? They enjoy, when they are there, the being that they enjoy is the being of the satyam, of that which actually is. And that is your experience. Like, for instance, with any thought that you have, any emotion that you have, any perception that you have, any experience that you have, comes and goes. And comes and goes means it wasn't here, it's here for the moment, and now it's gone. But because you remain, your being remains without even the slightest flicker, that doesn't bother you. You know, it's the same thing as waking up from the dream. That's why they use swapna. Swapna, the dream is one of the prakriyas, or one of the illustrations, what we call the drishtantas that we use, that is considered so powerful because it gives us an inkling of what this situation is, what this waking state is. Because when you have a dream, when you're in the dream, you're within duality, right? You're experiencing a world. You have a subject-object relationship. You are one among many, you know. You are the seer, the doer, the experiencer of this world until you wake up. And when you wake up, the subject-object relationship and the entire container, the entire world in which you find yourself, you and the world, are gone in an instant. And at the same time, nothing happens. The entire world disappears, but really, nothing happens. Why? Because it was only a dream. This is how we talk. It was only a dream. And the dream, when it's happening, is so very, very real. But when you wake up from it, the being of the dream has not changed in any way. The being of the dream is what is satyam, what is real. The dream stuff, the dream material, the dream experiences have no being. And so any attainment on that level, on the level of what's going on within the dual, within the dream reality, is not really an attainment for the one who has woken up from the dream. There's some type of sense of attainment for you while you're in the dream. But when you wake up from the dream, that attainment is ephemeral. It doesn't mean anything. It has no substance at all. And so here, he's talking, what is really, if all of the siddhis within this plane, this waking state, all of the siddhis, from the most magical, occult-like siddhis, to just the normal accomplishments in the world, all of them do have some sort of reality within duality, you know. But for one who has woken up from that, what is really the accomplishment? That's what he's saying. What is really the accomplishment? Because the self of every, the self, the truth of every attainment, of every image, of every event is already there. The being of every event is already there, full and complete. The events come and go. They come and go, enjoying for their self, for their reality, you. So you remain, and they come and go. And they will always come and go. And so where, for Jnani, where is an attainment? Where is there any attainment for something that by its very nature simply comes and goes? So he says the only attainment is the attainment of the attained. And in fact, this is something that they say, they have a phrase in Vedanta, it's called praptasya praptihi. You know, moksha, liberation, is praptasya praptihi. Praptihi means the attainment, praptasya of the attained. Praptasya praptihi. Why? Because sat, being, your being, the being who you are, is already attained. It's already a fact. It's already accomplished. It will never change. It's never be any different than what it is. So your attainment of it is the attainment of the attained, and the attainment of the attained can only take place through knowledge. Right? And knowledge can only take place through the elimination of ignorance. So once one recognizes, so now, just accepting that for the moment, when we, so this is all implied in here, when we go after an attainment in the world, I want this, and I want this, I want to achieve this, I want to accomplish this. Why? So that I can be happy, so that I can be full, so that I can be whole, so that I can be complete, so that I can be better than what I am, so that I can improve. It's a siddhi. If I can gather all of these things, whatever they may be, then I will be whole and complete. I will be full. I will be happy. And just on the simplest level, very simple level for all beings, I want this so that I can be happy. The whole world runs on it. In the Adyasa Bhasha of the Brahma Sutras, Shankara uses the example, you know, if you hold some nice fresh grass up to a cow, you know, the cow will trot over, you know, to eat the grass. If you hold a stick up to the cow will run away, right? And so, you know, everybody goes after what will give them sukha and goes away from what will give them pain. That's what's keeping the whole world running, you know. And so I project on my sukha, my ananda, on a variety of things. I could have this and this and this and this, you know, and that would make it for me. I would be happy. And of course, if I could get rid of this, this, and this also, that would make me happy. And you'll find in your life these things continually shift. Like sometimes I think this will be make me happy, but then I realize, no, after all, I don't want that now. I wanted that at one time. I don't want that now, right?
I want something better.
I want something else, you know. And this is a garage sale item now. So even people become garage sale items. Everything becomes a garage sale item at one time or another. So I want this now, and then I don't want that now. On and on it goes like that. That's all projection. If there was any ananda or my wholeness, my well-being was in the object, truly, and I got that object, then the problem is over. The problem is over if it really happened. That's not what we experience. We get the object, we feel happy for one moment, and then the ananda drips off the object and we're just left with the object. That's samsara. That's exactly samsara, you know. And so, here, what about when you recognize that in the totality of your experience, there's a couple of things here. First thing, what he's talking about is the recognition of sat, the differentiation of sat, what actually is being itself, that is really substrate, the actual being of all of the things that are coming and going. What if you recognize that? How are you going to recognize it? You can't recognize it by looking at it. If you're looking at it, it's got an object. Your sense organs are only good for perceiving objects. If there is something sat, it's not going to be an object in the world. It's going to be the self or the backdrop of all objects in the world. It's going to be the backdrop. And so if it's got to be the backdrop of all objects in the world, because it can't be objectified as an object, it'll become limited. It's got to be the one thing that in fact cannot be objectified, but which is. And who is that going to be? There's only one way for you to recognize it. Because if you use your sense organs to look out, right, your sense organs are only good for the perception and experience of duality. That's why what you have to do, and what the whole teaching of Vedanta is about, is to take you, take this experience. You can just think of it in terms of even a dream character in the dream. How is the dream character, using all of their sense organs, going to recognize the one from whom the whole dream has come, the very being which the whole dream enjoys? How is the dream character going to recognize it? So it's like that. So that like that for you. How are you sitting in this dream of this world, you know, as a player in the world? How are you going to see sat? Because it's not something that can be objectified. It's something which you are. It's like asking the pot to see the clay. You know, it's behind all of that. There's no. It's the very self of your sense organs. It's the very self of your mind. It's not something that the mind can turn around and objectify, because the self is there as the very substance. Mind can only go out this way and this way and this way. Even if it looks inside, it's looking. Right? So, what is sat is has to be discovered, has to be recognized. The gaining knowledge of sat is not of what is, of your amness, in fact. The isness, the being, is your amness. Gaining knowledge of that amness is not going to be gaining knowledge of a new experience, of something that's not there. It's going to be differentiating your being from all of the things that come and go. Things that come and go don't fulfill the definition of being. Things that come and go exist within duality. So you're the stable. Your amness is the stable. It's the stable one that's not coming, ever coming and going. How to recognize it? You have to be it. You are it. So you have to not, it's not about looking. It's about differentiating your own presence, just your own presence, from all of the things that rise and set in that presence. And your own presence set is not something that is inert. Being is not inert. Consciousness is not inert. Because consciousness also cannot be objectified. Being can't be objectified. Consciousness can't be objectified. So what do I say about myself? I might take it to be the body, mind, sensors. I say, I am a conscious being. You talk like that. I am a conscious being. I don't say there's some being over here and consciousness over here. The consciousness that I am is the being which I am. The consciousness that I am is the being that I am. And that's why in all of your experience we say everything enjoys set. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is. Every experience. Every experience on every level, it is. But there's something else on every level that is there. And that is, it is known. You cannot have an is experience without an is known experience. See that? Try it. Have a thought in your mind. Even have a thought in your mind of non-existence. And then non-existence is known. But that you can't escape that. On every single level, your being and the knownness, the self-evident, self-shining nature of your being is present, and it's pervasive to all experience. And so that's a fact. Now that fact has to be differentiated. You can't rediscover it. You can't have a new experience of it. You can only differentiate all of the things that can be objectified and that come and go from the one that is always there. Sat, what is Sat is always there. I am always here in exactly the same way without any modification whatsoever. And that me is self-evident, self-shining, Siddha. We say it is self-established, Swetha Siddha. I'm established, self-established, this word Swetha Siddha. I'm established in my own being, right? In other words, I am self-shining as consciousness. Consciousness, me, I don't need to bring another me in to light me up. You don't, just like you don't have to bring another sun to light the sun up, I don't need to bring in another me to light me up. Because I am, everything else is lit up. You know? That's why your mind and your thoughts which all come and go, they all come and go, but when they're there, they're known. They are and they are known. That thought goes, it is known. Gone. It is known. When you say it is known. Consciousness, consciousness is set, and set is consciousness. Now, once this has been discovered, I've discovered myself, and I see, now, this is another thing. I say I've discovered my being. Now, what do you say about this? I've discovered my being, the stability of me. I also discover, like just in this room, the stability of me, my being, is not away from any experience. Like, what would this mean to you? Like if I say, I see the painting, how far is the painting from me? You say, well, the painting is 10 feet from my body. But how far is the painting from me, the one who is, the conscious being? And how far are the flowers from me? And how far is this from me? How far are you from me? And the conscious being, from isness, from knownness, there is no distance. And so what Ramana is saying here, because once you recognize that, once you recognize yourself, then this body is coming and going just like every other object. The thoughts are coming and going just like every other object. Perceptions, emotions, moods, every experience that you have is coming and going just like everything else. And they're coming and going in the stability of yourself. And so once that is recognized. How do you get involved? This is Ramana, because of course you didn't get involved in it at all. Yeah. So how do you get involved in all of this? Yeah. What's going to pull you into the Maya? You know? What's going to pull you into the Maya? Maya means all of this duality. When none of it has any essence. You know, when you are the clay, you're the clay, not the pot. There's nothing but clay there. So say you say, all of these names and forms are nothing but me. They're nothing but consciousness. They're nothing but conscious being, and conscious being never changes. This changes all of the time. But this doesn't have any, this is like a swapna, it's like the dream. You don't have any problem saying that the dream is mitya, or the dream is maya. That's easy to say that, because you get to be the waker. You know, the dream's gone. But here you have to say, this is just like a dream, while you're still in it. That is the problem. You know, you get to wake up from the dream, and then it's easy to dismiss it as maya, as mitya. What maya, well, the definition of maya is that which is responsible for the manifestations of all names and forms. But if we break down the etymology of it, it's yama iti maya. That which is not, that is maya. But it's a play on words, because here it is. You can't say it's not here as though it's a sat. It has no being. It is here, but it has no being. The being that it has, it is free of it. That's satyam mitya. Just like the pot is totally dependent on the clay, and the clay doesn't even acknowledge the pot. Right? That's satyam. Satyam is that which is totally independent. Mitya is that which is totally dependent. Right, so clay pot is a good example for that. Rope snake is another one we use. Rope is, I mean, relatively speaking, from the standpoint of rope, there's no snake, but from the standpoint of the snake, it's totally dependent on the rope. And so now, say if you look at a thought in your mind, the thought is mitya. You know, it has no being. It has no being independent of being itself. It depends totally upon me for its being, because it comes into being and goes out of being. Being doesn't come into being and goes out of being. I don't come into being and go out of being. The thought comes into being and goes out of being. The emotion comes into being and goes out of being. I'm stable. But until I've recognized that, it all is jumbled into like one thing, a red hot iron ball. You know where the fire and the iron come together and they look like just one thing. If you don't know fire, and if you don't know iron, that's your self experience. You know, but with moksha, with liberation, you're not going to have a new self experience. The self experience is siddha. It's free of time. You are free of time. You know, it's not that there's going to be an arising of yourself. You're going to go, oh, you mean I am free. You know, it's like in the tenth man story. When the tenth man, you know, realizes, I am the tenth man. What has happened? He realizes, I am the tenth man. Swamiji will make a lot of fun of this. He'll say, the tenth man, once he realizes, you know, having counted off the other nine, and the old man says, you are the tenth man, when he realizes, I am the tenth man, you don't feel like bragging about it. You know? You don't feel like bragging about it. You know? Yeah. But knowledge, self-knowledge, is like that, because that's why Swamiji has said this knowledge is, the reality is so simple. It's so simple because, you know, the what you're seeking is who you are. You know, it couldn't be more simple, and it couldn't be closer to you, because it is you. What you're seeking is who you are. It's just that who you are has been superimposed upon this maya. And it's not that the self is doing any superimposition. It's the mind that has ignorance, just like in the dream character. You can't blame the dream character for not knowing. How on earth is the dream character going to know that I'm the self of the whole dream and the whole dream comes from me? How's it going to know that? That's why you need a means of knowledge. That dream character needs a guru, you know, to make him or her recognize their own being, and to recognize the absolute independence and freedom of your being, you know. Because if your being, if who you are, can't be objectified as an object in the world, consciousness is not objectifiable. You can't say, oh, look at the consciousness, look at the being. That's not possible, you know. All things within duality are objectifiable, and they're all subject to change, and they're all subject to the pramanas, to being perceived, and, you know, all of this type of thing. Consciousness isn't, though. Consciousness is self-evident. It's self-shining, but it's not something, you know, I can't hold up like an apple. Look at the consciousness. This is who you are. You know, you are that, but the knowledge, the teaching has to point to it so that you recognize it, so that who recognizes it? That's another problem. Who recognizes it? Well, actually, what happens is your mind differentiates, because of the teaching, it differentiates itself from the self-shining me. It makes this differentiation. It's the one that's shrouded in ignorance and causes the mind to be able to say, here's an example of the ahankar, the ignorance. The mind says, I am the conscious being. You know, I am a conscious being, taking itself, and I am an unhappy conscious being, you know, subject to death because I'm also the body. So it goes on and on. It's like a bouncing ball. It goes on and on. You know, how is this mind going to recognize that it itself is known, is illumined, and is continually changing in me who light it up? Right? See what has to happen? It's like this mind has to realize that it is objectified. It's a very freaky for the mind also when it first realizes, I am objectified. Everything about me, the mind, is known. Everything about me, the mind, is changing. Right? But I, true I, that's illumining it, is never changing. So the mind goes through a little kind of mini-death experience. And not really, but that's its fear, because it realizes that, in fact, me, the self, is free of it. Right? That it, in fact, is just coming and going in me that is never changing at all. At first it freaks it out, and then it realizes, but wait, I'm still here. The self, myself, myself, like the pot saying, myself is clay. I am clay. That's the see. See, the pot can say, wait a minute. I am clay. In fact, there's nothing here but clay. I am the clay. See what I mean? And it is the clay. This is what happens to the mind. The mind will say, I am the self, but I, the self, am free of the mind. See how it can say that? Its truth is the self. The only, the very being that it enjoys is only the self. And it had, the mind had taken itself, the Maya, to be responsible for that being. Mm. The mind had taken itself to be responsible for me. Mm. That's a huge burden, because this mind, and it's kind of a nightmare, because the mind is always changing and having all of these types of moods and thoughts and becoming happy and sad and agitated and angry, and so it's going through so many different things. It's also losing its memory and all of these things that are happening to all of us as we grow up. So this mind, then taking itself to be me, is also realizing that it's going to crumble and die, and so then I will also. So once it realizes that, I, what it's referring to as I, is free. In fact, the mind says, I am free. Me, that I am the self, and the self is free. And that whatever changes this mind goes through, it's fine. It doesn't mean anything. Nothing happens. And it feels the same way about the body. This body is finite, but I am free. So that's the funny, very funny thing to understand about this relationship that we call the relationship, which is the whole teaching, really, is the Satyam Nitya. I mean, Satyam Nitya is clay pot, where you recognize that this whole universe, in fact, everything that is, everything that is, the isness of everything that is real. That is Brahman. The being is Brahman. Is. That isness, that being, that is knownness, that is Brahman. And all of the names and forms that take place in this is knownness are mitya. Means they have no being of their own. The being that they depend on is the changeless being of Satyam. And so it is true, you say everything, this is, and they from the table can say, I am, everybody can say, I am. You know? That's all true, it's absolutely true. But what isn't said is that the amness which I am is free of the object. That the object depends upon me, the experiences depend upon me, but I don't depend upon them. If you that isn't understood, then I have to search for an experience. Right? Because my mind will have to look for an experience of the self that's not already here. Right? And then it doesn't really mean very much, because if the self that I'm searching for is not already here, then somebody else is going to get liberated, not me. Right? It's the same problem we have, if there's a soul that goes to heaven when I die, who cares if I die? If I'm going to die, who cares about any soul that goes to heaven? That only means something if I go to heaven, you know? So, if you think that there's a big self to be experienced, some other self somewhere else, then what about you? You're the one that you're attached to, not some unknown self. You could say, well, if I could go and have the experience of this unknown self, then that's fine, because then I'll be there having the experience of the unknown self, the magical self to be achieved. But I don't want that experience if I lose myself in the meantime. You see what I mean? So moksha really has to, if there's such a thing as moksha, liberation, we're talking about, and we use the words, we're talking about self-liberation, right? I want to be liberated. I want to be free. And so, it's not somebody else or some unknown I to be reached. I want to be free. And that I that we're talking about is what all the mystics refer to. That is the beloved. The discovery is that in fact that I is, that we're talking about, is what is most dear to you. You can say, I'll take all of these experiences, they're all fine as long as I can be there. You're not going to say, let me have these experiences and annihilate myself in the meantime. No, I'll take myself without the experience. So, what is the self? What is that self that is most dear to you? That's the most obvious thing in the world, and for some reason, it has to dawn on us. It's that your very being that is fully present right now, the one because of whom all experience is known. I am the center of all of my experience. This me that is always present as me, the most intimate me, that it is this self, right? This self that is Brahman, this self that is changeless, this self that is inviolate. No matter what experience you have, this self is there. You are there. So the whole thing is, okay, can I, once I recognize that, then can I get rid of it? Can I, even in this waking state, is there any way, can I have any experience in which I am not there? And you just try. And then you'll say, there is no experience where I'm not there. It's not possible. And I can get rid of all experience and I'm still there. With or without any experience, I'm still there. And so that's why he says, for a person who's realized this, who's abiding in that being, has recognized that, how again can you go to Maya? It's not even possible, because you are always there of this, the changeless self of every single experience you have. And you've recognized, when you recognize yourself, you recognize what is most dear to you. You are the Ananda. Ananda is not just some sort of bliss experience. It isn't a bliss experience. A bliss experience is Maya again. A bliss experience comes and goes. You don't come and go. And you are most dear. And so that is something that has to be discovered. Because also, in this whole thing, sorry. In this whole thing, you're the Ananda that you're seeking has to come home to you. See, the problem is also that even words like being in existence and consciousness can be almost theoretical. They don't necessarily, these words themselves, they have to land on you. But the word, like consciousness is a dry word. You know, I'm consciousness. Who says that? You know, it's a dry word. Or I am existence, or I am being. These words aren't good enough. They kind of have an academic feel. When you think about you, you know, you are conscious. But you have to think about you, your own nature, just your own personal self. And then if I say, are you conscious? Then you say, yes, I am. But it has to, the word has to land on you. So if you think, this me that makes me me, is it consciousness? Is it conscious? Is it self-evident? Am I self-evident? Yes, I could say I was self-evident. See what I mean? So these words are not good in themselves. They have to land on you and then see if that word applies. Then you say, okay, me, do. Does my being, that what makes me me, can I change it? Can I make it different? I can make my thoughts different. I can make my emotions different. Should my perceptions different? You know, all these things I can make different, but can I make me, my own presence, different? Can I change it? Try. If you can, that's not it. You can't change your own presence, your own very personal self. You try, do all kinds of things. Can you put a bag over it? Can you dim it? No, you can do absolutely nothing. And so then you say, oh, that's why they say I'm changeless, because there's no way to change it. No matter what I'm thinking or feeling or experiencing, there's nothing I can do about me. It is always, always there, and I can't touch it in any way. So then the words start making sense. But they only make sense when you're applying it to you. See what I mean? Because you are very personal. You are you. What makes you you? Then you can ask questions like about yourself. Like you can say, is there anything more dear to me than me? Like you can say, all these things are dear in the Upanishad, Aranyaka Upanishad, there's one section. You know, where I think it's Gargi's being taught by her husband. And he says, you know, you love your child for the sake of yourself, because your child makes you happy. You love your partner, your husband, for the sake of yourself, because your husband makes you happy. What about when they don't make you happy? You love all of your wealth for the sake of yourself. You know, all of these things are only for you, for your sake. So you are the one who is most beloved, right? Because all of these things are to serve you, and if they're not serving you, you don't even want them. So you are the one who is really the most beloved. So what is just ask yourself, is there anything more dear than me. We're not talking about your mind or your body. You're talking about that core, the core of your who you are. And that is Brahman. That who you are, that is the reality. And once that's known, then and wherever you are there. How can you go out into this? Into all of these names and forms? You won't, because you are the self of all of these names and forms, and you are the Ananda. See, this is what they mean by Ananda. Ananda is not a bliss experience. That's a big, to translate Ananda as bliss is a huge mistake, because bliss experiences come and go. Ananda is your being, which is so dear, is the most dear, and it's that recognition. And wherever you go, that most dear is there. And that most dear is Krishna. You know, where Krishna means the one who enjoys all Ananda. Or is Bhagawan, is Ishwara, whatever words you want to use, but it is you, in fact. It is yourself. And so, Ramana is always bringing it back home to who you are. Once you know yourself, how is there any going out into Maya? You can't. Wherever you go, you are there. And you are the most beloved. You are the very self that is changeless. So there's no going out into any kind of Maya again, he says. And he says, how can somebody who has woken up from the dream take the dream so very, very seriously? You know, you're not going, if once you've woken up from the dream, you can't take the dream as satya, as real. It's not possible because you've woken up from it. You can't go back. You know, and so once you've recognized yourself, and he says, sati stittaha, means the one who's abiding there, means their mind has really recognized it. You know, then how again can you see anything else? Because there's nothing, it's not a question of forgetting, because the fact is always there. You forget something that's not there. But you can't forget what's always there. You see what I mean? There's no way to forget something that's always there. It has to go away for you to forget it. So, okay. Let's stop there. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishite Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
You know what always gets me, and I still don't understand how, from the yoga philosophy standpoint, when they use that samadhi experience, then that's somehow to equate moksha. Or I don't understand.
But the situation there is the yoga, Patanjali yoga, is associated with Sankhya, the Sankhya philosophy. And with the Sankhya philosophy says that the universe instead of Maya, they call it Prakriti. Still Setra, Rajas, and Tamas. And there's still the Panchikarana of going through the process of unfoldment into this creation, the Maya, manifesting as the five elements and the Setra, Rajas, and Tamas aspect of all of that. So they have all of that. But they look at Prakriti as being beginningless and real. So Prakriti is matter, that there is a physical matter, physical including the intelligence principle, the active principle, but it's still material. It's still Sattva as a material, Rajas. It's all matter and it is real. Now they say also that the Purushas, each Purusha, there are infinite Purushas, and each Purusha is like an Atma. It's like there are infinite number of Atmas because each one is Satchidananda. And there are countless number of them. And so now, that being, so it's total Dvaita. Sankhya is total Dvaita. So then if they look at, they take this individual part, piece of Prakriti, the Jiva, and what this Jiva that has body, mind, sense organs, right, it has to bring the Prakriti into a state of total equipoise. It's called something like a samana avastha or something, into a total equipoise, so that this matter will not be interfering with the experience of the Purusha. And so it has to actually come into total equipoise and, in a sense, turn toward the Purusha, so it is no longer contributing any experience. And when that happens, which takes place through a lot of discipline and a lot of meditation, to bring the mind into a subhikalpa and the nirvikalpa comes off of the subhikalpa. You can't have nirvikalpa without first subhikalpa. So you go into a nirvikalpa samadhi where the prakriti now is not really contributing any type of dvaita, any type of dual experience. And that has to be practiced for some time until there's like an anuvritti, an ongoing, like if I keep practicing something for long enough, I get a natural recurring flow. It's like the flow of the prakriti is going this way, in away from any type of duality. And that anuvritti, that continuing flow, doesn't change. So that takes a lot of practice, and really until the body drops, that samadhi has to be practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced. Because if you don't, like a bouncing ball, the prakriti can come out into the world again. And so nirvikalpa samadhi is very, very important for the yoga practitioner who is associating their yoga with the Sankhya philosophy. Now when we use yoga, or other disciplines all over the world use yoga, they're not associating the yogic practice with Sankhya. But if they are, then this practice of samadhi is extremely important, because the real prakriti has to come into a state of equipoise so the Purusha can be free to just abide as the Purusha. You know, just abide in its own nature. And it's not Vedanta. With Vedanta, you are Ishvara. Right, and so this infinite creation is Ishvara. You know, and Ishvara, the creation manifests and unmanifests. It's kind of like an infinite mind. Sometimes the mind's awake, sometimes the mind's in nirvikalpa naturally. Then the universe mind is awake, the universe mind is in nirvikalpa. It's awake, it's in nirvikalpa. That's who you are, in fact. Whereas with the Sankhya, the physical universe is a physical universe that includes the mind and sense organs and all that. That has to be brought under control through tremendous discipline. This is the yama, niyama, pranayama, all of these things are meant and designed to bring the prakriti to a state of equipoise so that the Purusha can be set free.
Now, when you say when the body drops, is that then what they call a mahasamadhi?
Yeah, but if the prakriti has been brought to that state of absolute equipoise, when this body drops, then the Purusha is free. That Purusha is free. And no longer has any associative, any experience of the prakriti.
Is this just in theory, or are they actually, is there groups of practice that we're talking about?
Well, there are groups that, like yoga, and they're practicing the yam and niyam, all of that, pranayama. We practice all of that too, but in a totally different way, for a totally different outcome, for a totally different reason. And, but they practice it in order to have a samadhi experience, and then to have a repeating samadhi experience, to having and maintaining a samadhi experience until the body drops. That's what it amounts to. And so that their purusha in the end can be freed. So it's very totally experienced.
Well, that's a lot of work, isn't it?
A lot of work, and very disappointing. Very disappointing, also.
A lot of work for something that doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work for something that doesn't work.
No guarantees here.
It is what it is. Sankhya is actually, in the scheme of things in India itself, Sankhya is considered very philosophically very weak, because there's a lot of. I could go on and. With all of the problems with it.
Is there an Advaita commentary on Patanjali?
I heard there was. Did you hear there was? Somebody has it.
There was, but I've never.
I heard there was too. I haven't seen it myself. I think Olga Vichakova, one of my students, she told me about it. I think she has it. And Swamiji may have it too, because Swamiji teaches Patanjali Yoga.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. You know, when Ramanand Patel is a student of Swamiji's, and he's a great yoga person. And so every year at the ashram, they have Ramanand comes with some helpers, and they have a camp, like a yoga camp. And Swamiji will teach the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, but from in a Vedantic way. And I've read them too. I like them, but you have to. It depends on what philosophical system you're superimposing on them.
Can I ask you something about the translation?
Sure.
The first line, can Ava mean only?
Yeah.
Okay.
Only. So. It can mean only and indeed.
So it could be sort of like the, and viti, that's the same as vidya?
Yeah, vid. It's all from the root vid.
Vid.
So vitti is kind of an unusual form. The T affix, let me just explain it to you. There's an affix T like shruti, you know. Buddhi is a T affix. So when vid takes on that T, the da changes to ta. It becomes vid T, becomes vitti. And it's a feminine noun. It means knowledge or knowing. So in the commentary, and he says, how a commentary works, if I go into it, I'll say vittihi vedanam. It gives a synonym.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And vedanam also is from vid.
Oh, yeah.
All of these are from the same root. Yeah.
And siddhasya means.
So Ava can be only, you know, like the.
So it could be sort of like the accomplishing the knowledge of being is the only accomplishment or something like
that? It would be like this. The vittihi, the knowledge, satta of sat, which is siddha, siddhasya satta, if I put it in order, siddhasya satta.
You already established.
Sat. Alone, eva, is the siddhi, is the accomplishment.
Is the only accomplishment.
That is the only, that alone is the accomplishment.
Okay.
The rest, all other accomplishments are like the dream.
Right.
Swapna upamanaha. Siddhiyaha anyaha. Siddhiyaha is siddhi in plural, nominative plural. The siddhis, anyaha, the other siddhis.
Mm-hmm.
The other siddhis are swapna upamanaha. Upamana is like, the same as the dream.
If you're saying it that way, it's got a lot more bite than the way. This translation says the knowledge of the established truth itself is an accomplishment. But it sounds like he's saying, really, the only accomplishment is.
Yeah, he's saying it's the only. Yeah, this is the only accomplishment, really.
The
all the
rest
others
of them
are.
Don't amount to a hill of beans.
They're not real, yeah. They don't mean anything. Yeah, exactly.
And it's kind of like this thing of accomplishing the accomplished.
That's what it is, exactly. See, he says, like when you read these bhashas, for sattaha, he says, for siddhasya, he gets synonyms. Akritikasya, that which has not been made. Right? Nityasya, that which is free from time. Sattaha. So sat is that which is timeless, which is never, is akrita. Krita means it's, for, krita means for something to be made. It has a beginning, right? It's made. There's a prior condition. So if you say something is nitya, means free from time, and it's akrita, it's never been created. It's uncreated. So for that is what they mean by siddha, that which already is. It's already established. So it's knowledge of sat, which is already siddha, alone, that is siddhi, the accomplishment. Siddhiyaha anyaha, all other siddhis, are swapna upamanaha. They're like the dream.
This commentary you're reading is by who?
Oh, it's just the only commentary we really have that I know of. Is it by? Swami uses this one too. It's not by Shankara, because Shankara, yes, in Sanskrit. It's the one that if you read any commentaries that any I've seen, they're based on this one.
Oh, so it's some Swami since the time of Ramana Maharshi.
Yeah. Shri Vashishta Ganapati Muni.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's,
well, he's the one that translated it from Tamil to Sanskrit.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, because Ramana wrote it up mostly in Tamil, right?
Yeah.
So, Vasishta Ganapati Muni, Virachita. Virachita means it's written.
And he was supposed to be one of the great Sanskrit scholars in the South.
Yeah. His commentary is nice.
Mm.
Not hard to read also without a lot. You don't have to be a huge Sanskrit scholar to read it. It's nice. But Shankara is also, his Sanskrit is very clean, very beautifully written, not like the kavya in poetry. The Sanskrit is so hard. They write it like a puzzle. For you to really have to work on.
It's challenging.
Yeah, though. Even for other pundits, they make it so, let's see if you can read this.
Modern literature.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Joyce or something.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that was impossible.
Yeah.
If awareness is a conscious being is without time, so that when they were talking, they were using the pramana.
Yeah.
Long ago in India.
Yeah.
So this understanding, it doesn't evolve. I mean, you know, with the planet, you feel like there's evolution and things become more modern and evolved.
Well, within duality, that accumulation of knowledge is endless. It's infinite. So we'll continue learning and learning and learning. But here, that isn't so. Like, if say you wanted to learn about the Ishwaras,
knowledge develops and
grows,
and
infinitely.
Grows and gets more insight and more accurate, more precise,
endlessly.
Yeah.
But so here, knowledge of yourself is knowledge of yourself. Your self-knowledge is not going to grow in terms of your recognition of your being. Because it is what it is. It doesn't have any parts or anything like that. It is what it is. But understanding of Dharma and understanding of Ishwara and the inner relationships of people, even in light of your knowledge, that goes on. You go on growing and growing and learning and learning. You know, because it's relative. You're learning it in the light of Satyamitya. You're learning it in the light of understanding everything is Ishwara, everything is Maya, all of that. These are big sweeping understandings. But just in the day-to-day carrying on, you learn endlessly. Because that involves Dharma.
Well, does that complicate it? Because it seems like, you know, 4,000 years ago things were more simple, more agrarian.
It doesn't complicate it because all the while, in all of the complexity of the creation, you're exactly the same.
Yeah.
So it's not really about relative knowledge. The relative knowledge goes on and on and on. And it's beautiful also. Even the understanding of Dharma, or gaining, you know, they say karma yoga. Karma yoga is the prasada buddhi, prasada, where you take everything really as prasada from Ishwara. You do your karmas, and then you receive the results of those karmas as prasada, the prasada buddhi. It's called Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. It's all, everything is really in service of Ishwara, understanding, recognition of Ishwara. That's one part of karma yoga. The other part, though, is kaushalam. Kaushalam means kind of skill in action, where you have to learn how to be in the world also. You know, how to make proper choices. That's also necessary in karma yoga. There's a certain learning how to make the proper choices. And how to negotiate, how to be with others in the world. That's challenging. You know, how to be a good person, all of these types of things.
Yeah, but it can also be confusing, because it can unsettle your knowledge of your own of yourself and the freedom that it has to offer. Because if you're not real skillful in the world, it'll disturb that freedom. I mean, because you're being harassed.
No.
Yeah.
No, that's because in reference to that, there's not any vairagya. In the end, that vairagya has to come. You know, but you still go on learning. You still go on. The learning itself can be a joy, and you can enjoy your learning, you know. But what about, you know, when you want things to be different? That's the problem. It's a very pleasing journey, because you keep, after a point, after you get over the...
After you get it.
And then after you get over some of the big humps, but... You know, because you start really letting Ishwara be Ishwara. You know, and there are really challenging things in the world, like even in your mind. Say, for instance, this is a sad type of example, but like if a mother, for instance, were to lose her child, if that's such a tragic thing were to happen, it is not like for the parents, it's not like in your lifetime the effects of that loss won't be there. It becomes part of your makeup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a suffering. There's a sadness there. Mm-hmm. It's part of your world experience. And so it wouldn't be fair or right or kaushalam, really, to say, oh...
Get over it.
Get over it. I'm 60 now. I should have gotten over this, even when it happened. It's not... No. There's no reason... You don't necessarily get over experiences. But they don't have to be torturous to you either. But they're there. It's not like your mind is all of a sudden not going to think about that. You know? It will think about that. And at some point, you just say, isn't that interesting? That's how it is.
Yeah.
You don't say, I don't think that I'm supposed to be thinking about that anymore. Well, in fact, you are thinking about it. And maybe that's how it is. Like, say if somebody in war loses their leg, their whole life, they have to deal with that. They're not going to not be thinking about it. See what I mean? It's there. There's hard things that happen in life. And the mind could think the whole life about it. But what if you were just to say, gee, that's interesting. My mind may think my entire life, it may think about these things. Because the other The other idea that you may have is that certain all experiences are supposed to, you know, that I'm only supposed to think about something or feel about something for a certain length of time. And I don't think that's true. I think that there's things that happen in life that can go with you the entire life. And what if you say, all right, that's fine. That's how it is. Instead of making a big deal about it and saying, oh, that's not supposed to be how it is. Well, maybe that is supposed to be how it is. You know, people live with illness for their entire life. People live with maimed limbs their entire life. So people live with emotional events that may have occurred their entire life. It's just, but the thing is, the way you live with that, those feelings, when they first happen, may be much different than how you live with those feelings 20 years later or 30 years later. I just think it's not true to think that all the experiences that you have in your life will totally go away. So in psychology also, we don't accept it, but the thing is that for me, as I go, you know, I go on realizing these things on different levels, and there's a tremendous freedom in when you start not just allowing your mind and your world of experience to be how it is, and instead of saying it's supposed to be different. I don't think it is supposed to be different. This is what it is. And some things, some hurts or big experiences, mm-hmm. you know, can go all the way through your life. But you may be holding them a little differently. And especially when you have a certain vairagya, and you can honestly say, yeah, that's there, that's what it is. Yeah. And that's different than saying, oh, that's there and I don't care about it. No, it's there and I care about it, and that's how it is.
And you can't complain about that, then. I mean,
it's not even about complaining, it's an accepting of the reality and accepting that. So if you say that's not complaining about it, I can say, yeah, I'm not complaining about that, but that's not at all to say that it's not there. Yeah. It is there. And there's something really profound about that.
Yeah.
There's something in my very limited experience about the act of taking it, whatever comes up, the internal, external, as prasad, that it's more than just that it's going to be there, or at least in my experience. It's, you know, taking this on as a gift in a way. And sometimes it's more challenging with certain things. But there's such a big shift in the response to it.
Yeah. And in fact, that gift, sometimes the word gift can be Pollyannish, but there is some quality of it's kind of hard for me to call some things a gift, but there is a giftedness about them because we learn a lot. It gives a certain character or depth or something. I don't know quite how to say it, but there's instead of gift, I see things as in terms of karma, you know. And then we grow from our karma, and that's a gift. But I know what you're saying. Since I have to get to it sometimes a little circuitously.
Yeah, sometimes the best that it can be is a learning opportunity. Yeah. And in that sense, a gift.
Yeah. And it is that all the things are a learning opportunity. Vairagya, the learning of vairagya, is the great learning. That's the great learning, and that learning gives you where the ananda is. Every little step of vairagya is more and more freedom. You know? But that vairagya, you know, that is the dispassion, where it's all right, where you just allow that to be, and it's okay.
Well, there's not a formula for that growth, is there? I mean,
no, everybody has their own sequence.
Process. Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that vairagya really takes place in reference to your own mind, your own emotions, mm-hmm. your own ideas, your own everything.
Maturity,
everything. Mm-hmm. Where there's a letting the Ishvara be. And that's amazing. It's an amazing process. Endless. Because it goes to the most subtle levels of your personality.
Even as to your own faults.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Everything. It's not that if you have a fault and it's bothering you, some people might think you have faults that you don't even recognize as faults. but the ones that you recognize as a fault, you're making whatever natural efforts you do to change it. But you're just doing that because that's the human thing to do. But there's an acceptance. You just doing your best. Even the acceptance of, being not a good person or a bad person, you're both. You're a good person and a bad person. You're not a perfect person in terms of your life. To not even expect to be a perfect person, whatever that means. You just do your best. If somebody says, are you a really good person? Well, what are we going to say? No. I'm doing my best. That's what most people say.
Yeah.
I have that value. I'm doing my best. Yeah. And that's all we can do. It's like in the Bible, which sometimes there's some things in the Bible that once in a while I like. Not that many things, but there are a few. when somebody asked Jesus if he was a good person, said something like, "You are a good person," and he says, "I'm not a good person. Only the Father is a good person. Only my Father is a good person." It's like saying only the Atma, only the Self is good, really. In Maya, everything has its shadow. It's impossible. And so to think that you're supposed to be so great, I think is silly.
What was that again?
To think you're supposed to be so great and so good and all of this, I gave up on that. I'm doing my best. And I think everybody is, honestly.
If you frame it as karma, like what comes your way, then it's like everything exactly the way how it's supposed to be.
Exactly, and that's what Swamiji said, I really live by some things, somebody says something just at the right time for you and it means something. And one of the things he said is, I get what I deserve. That can be taken in a negative way, but it helps me. I get what I deserve. It's all karma. And whatever's coming my way, I'm part of this constellation and I'm as much a part of it as everybody else in the situation. And so this is my share in this situation, good or bad, And that allows you to relax in it.
And so it's also like almost like coming to a point where I'm tired arguing with karma or the universe. What's the point? I can bang my head against the wall. I want something that is like, there's no point in it.
That's why in that Gita verse, I think, what is it in chapter 6, I think, where Krishna is maybe a crux of it, he says to Arjuna, you go ahead and be responsible for your actions, do dharma and all of that, but know that I am the karma paladatta. Mm-hmm. The results come from me. Because it's too complex. You're just one little actor in this complex maze, of competing, karmas. So.
Well, when you say that, do you mean like on daily events or?
Always. That's why, why one person can do. Swamiji used the example, it's kind of a stock example we use. You get two people of equal intelligence, just imagine it, equal intelligence, equal opportunity, and they both start, they both start a store. Same store, an equal setting, and one becomes wealthy and one fails. Why? Karma.
Because what was it, the Apple Store, and it was the Beckles.
I mean, is it that current? I mean, that tangible?
Well, I think it's a way of understanding the universe and understanding your limitations as a jiva within a very complex universe. And to think that you have control over it is delusional, actually. Right? Because if we really had control over the thing, we could always get what we wanted.
Yeah.
But we don't. It's always a gamble. You don't know. You know?
Radha, I have a question, and I don't know just how to ask it. But, you know, you've been telling us to kind of think who I really am, you know. Mm-hmm. It's
just your own being.
Yeah. And it seemed to me like if we're already that, you know, what the question is, but it just seemed like, you know, something was bothering me, and, you know, I might think of it in some negative way, or, you know, maybe someone else's fault. But then if I think of myself as, you know, being Atma,
well, that's the thing.
It's different.
No, but Edie, at any given moment, there's the mind and all of its thinking and all of its problems and everything, and there's you. You don't have any problems. Your own being is just stable and always the same, illumining the mind that's having its problems. So when the mind recognizes that it has a self, it has a stable self, then it starts having a home base. You know, and so because until the mind makes that differentiation, it doesn't have a home. It's the home. And sometimes it's a happy home, and sometimes it's an unhappy home. But once you realize, the mind realizes that its problems and the things it's trying to work out, it's doing that in a home base that's benign, which is yourself. That's a big relief for the mind. Mm. You know, and then the problems that it's having, you start to learn how to work with them a little differently, and you work with them in the light of this knowledge, and your mind starts settling down. But really, the first big settling is the recognition of the mind that it has a home that is benign. You know, that it has a self that is changeless and full and whole and complete. You know, and so then within that, then the mind starts also becoming more secure. The mind has a lot of insecurity because the world is insecure. Why shouldn't it be insecure? What's secure here? Nothing's secure. Not even any love relations or anything. You know, everybody's going to die anyway. So no relationship is secure, and then people change their minds. They fall in a lot of love, they have 60% divorce and all of that. What's secure? There isn't anything. How, you know? Anything can happen at any time, so why should the mind, it's not stupid, why should it be insecure? But when it recognizes the self, that the self is secure. It's the only thing that's secure, because it's free of time.
How does it come in? I mean, you said, like, to realize the mind is... I never really thought about the mind as an object.
Because it's known,
It's known.
It's known, and yeah, that makes it an object.
It's so close that it's so hard to make it an object for me.
But you know when you sit in meditation, like, say, you do Vipassana?
Right, you just see it coming down. It's written.
Yeah. Now you have to recognize your own presence. Mm-hmm. It's coming and going in your presence. Mm-hmm. And then you start recognize that, I'm always here. That the me, all its thoughts are coming and going in me, in fact. I'm never changing at all in any way. And I become the home base for the mind, which is a huge relief for the mind.
When you put it as like thoughts coming and going, these are objects, that's clear to me.
Yeah.
But somehow doing the other step of, you know, maybe then
you know what?
Clarifying what the mind is as a definition.
Look at the mind as thought flow.
Just thought flow.
Just thought flow. There's different types of thoughts. Like there's the I thought, there's the intellect, there's memory, but it's just thought flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then recognize, when you recognize that the mind is known, then recognize the consciousness, the me, that's not coming and going as the thoughts are coming and going. And get used to that one.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's kind of like a little, because the knowledge taken when we're listening, it is the mind that we're using.
That's right. But all of these, like you're listening and all of this, so the words are coming and going, but your presence is not coming and going.
Yeah.
Now, one meditative technique that's very good for really seeing that is japa. Maybe I'll do japa again. Japa meditation.
Yeah, I always love those.
Yeah. Japa is so powerful for that because when you're repeating a mantra, first it's, and you go like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, and then you go, after you do that for a while, then you go Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, and it looks like it's mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence, but after a while, and then you go Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, and you realize that the mantra is rising in silence and setting in silence, and the silence, that backdrop, me, is totally untouched. So that is the reality. That's the satyamitya. That's the reality of every thought that you have, every feeling that you have, every perception that you have. You are the silent backdrop presence in which these thoughts are coming. So you know japa?
Yeah. A little bit.
Maybe
It's not a practice I've done much.
You know, I'll teach it because there's certain ways to. There's a way to teach it, and then you can try it. We'll try it in class maybe next time we get class. I'm going to be gone, right? Everybody knows that. I'm going to send out an email.
You'll be here next Sunday.
Maybe. I have to think about it. But I definitely won't be here Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Yeah, planning to be here.
That's okay.
Sunday's not okay.
Your facial
expression. Well, it wouldn't hurt.
I don't know if I'll have a big family get together. Yeah. But I'm not sure.
Bring them over here.
Oh, yeah.